Good morning. I call the House Prevention and State Agency Oversight Committee to order. A quorum is established. And today we are going to be discussing the roadmap to program integrity and fraud prevention, followed by an informational hearing and discussion of periodic data matching. Before we begin, is there anyone in the Department of Human Services in the audience? I don't see anyone, so I just want to note for the record that DHS was invited to be available in the audience to answer questions today after Judge O'Malley's presentation, and they have apparently declined to come, which is very frustrating. This is the second hearing DHS has failed to appear at with an invitation, and I will continue to have conversations with Commissioner Gandhi about this. We absolutely need their cooperation in fighting fraud, and we expect them to come. I understand the commissioner is very busy. She may not always be able to attend, but there are a lot of employees at that agency. Someone who especially can speak to periodic data matching should have been here for that portion of the hearing. So next, we will approve the minutes. Vice Chair Anderson, do you approve the minutes from March 2nd?
I move approval.
Thank you. Representative Anderson has moved approval of the minutes of March 2nd. Is there any discussion? Not seeing any. All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed, nay. The minutes are adopted. So now we will move to our first presentation today. I would very much like to welcome Judge Tim O'Malley, the Director of Program Integrity, to the witness table for his presentation on his roadmap to program integrity and fraud prevention. Welcome to the committee, Judge O'Malley. We appreciate you being here and look forward to your testimony. You can begin by stating your name for the record.
I'm sorry, could you say that again, Madam
President? Please just begin by stating your name for the record.
My name is Tim O'Malley, O-M-A-L-L-E-Y. I'm the Director of Program Integrity for the state of Minnesota.
Welcome. Please begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Minnesota has experienced extensive, well-documented fraud in programs designed to serve the state's most vulnerable residents. The state's ineffectiveness in combating that fraud has wasted taxpayer dollars, enriched criminals, eroded public confidence, and impeded the delivery of essential services to Minnesotans in need. I was tasked with identifying contributing factors or causes, then offering recommendations based on those factors, so that the state could improve its approach to preventing and combating fraud. The end product is the roadmap to program integrity and fraud prevention, which was issued 2 weeks ago. The review of past practices shows that, going back at least a half century, every administration and legislative body was made aware of the vulnerabilities in program integrity. Until recently, the state's corrective actions to reduce or eliminate those longstanding vulnerabilities have been ineffective, and criminals have exploited those vulnerabilities to steal from the state. The review undertaken identified causes that are multifaceted and sometimes interrelated. The recommendations offered arise directly out of and correlate to those identified causes and contributing factors. The roadmap provides suggestions that could be part of a workable improvement plan, a way to re-engineer the state's approach so as to better prevent fraud in the future and to prevent fraud, particularly at the front end, before any money is lost, but also to detect fraud that is taking place more promptly and then take countering actions to stop it and claw back any monies that were already dispersed. The intent of the roadmap is to set the stage for long-term planning by identifying 9 pillars or areas for improvement. As mentioned, some are interrelated. Success in one area will be helpful in other areas. The 9 areas are, first, leadership, accountability, and culture. Accountability across the board and a fraud prevention mindset are needed for lasting improvements to succeed. Raising awareness and setting expectations. Everybody has a role to play in combating fraud, including state employees, leaders in the executive and legislative branches, managed care organizations, providers, and recipients. The second area, program processes and controls. Enhance enrollment and provider screening at the front end. set standards and verifiable criteria, then apply those consistently across all programs and all funding types. There is an opportunity here to partner with MCOs, yet still oversee their activities. They have a vested interest in preventing fraud. This is one of the areas, the program processes and controls, is one of the areas being worked on by the Office of Inspector General's Coordinating Council. Waypoint is also working on standardization here so that there are consistent and fair approaches across all programs. The third area, administrative, investigative, and prosecutorial coordination. Create a more centralized approach to investigate suspicious activities and a more efficient way for information to be shared promptly among agencies and with law enforcement. Obviously, technology will play a role here. Use of investigative resources should be prioritized so that fraudsters are dealt with swiftly and legitimate providers are recognized for their proficient compliance actions. Also, utilize administrative tools and investigative resources to aggressively pursue overpayments and fraudulent disbursements. Four, training and workforce development. It's a very straightforward proposal. Raise awareness and emphasize that all have a role to play in combating fraud. Make it clear, employees, providers, recipients, whatever they do, if they see something that appears suspicious, ensure that the supervisor that gets reported to are equipped to follow through. Legislative actions. You have a lot of work in front of you. I understand that. I suspect one of the challenges for the legislature will be, in coordination with the executive branch, prioritize next steps and decide where funding should be allotted at this time. Some improvements will be costly, others not so much. I'll mention more about that in a moment. I would be remiss, though, if I didn't point out that the underlying causes are not exclusively the result of the actions or inactions of the executive branch. Past legislators, and not just those who served decades ago, but some who are serving still today, could have done more. The way program funding is set out in legislation and the influence that legislators have, both during the session and during other months of the year, have been contributing factors. Lastly, one recommendation is to do away with direct appropriations. Eliminate earmarks. Why substitute your judgment for that of skilled, trained employees with the expertise to vet applicants and potential providers? If there is a sole source best suited to carry out a project, that entity will emerge through the process. If that sole provider needs help navigating the process, the state already has in place ways to assist them so that they are capable of operating in compliance with requirements and can withstand the scrutiny that comes with the responsibility of receiving state funds. Technology and data modernization. This is the sixth area. This is a potent and essential area for improvement. Modern criminal schemes require modern tools. Data sharing, use of analytics, monitoring tools such as GPS, biometrics, cameras must be leveraged. Seven, oversight and independent monitoring. We know that well-intended plans in the past were not successful. Independent oversight, similar to the type that accompanies consent decrees in other settings, would go a long way towards executing a plan that will be effective and will last. Stakeholder collaboration and engagement. The legitimate providers I've met with are committed to a greater good. They are skilled and capable. They have a grasp of the issues and the challenges. They want to prevent fraud as much as anyone else does. They should be at the table so that a workable, practical solutions are ultimately implemented. The last factor, resource and capacity building. It's another straightforward recommendation. There are resources within the state government that could be reallocated and have been reallocated, and that should be expanded. For example, in the areas of auditing and data analytics. Expanding resources in those areas and funding new endeavors, such as with technology, is needed. Thus, the importance of the work of this committee and other committees that's taking place now in the House and Senate. As you consider the recommendations and prioritizing next steps, and determining a budget, I would suggest that two areas in particular should be addressed sooner rather than later. One will be costly, but solutions are available. The other is less costly, but requires a focused and comprehensive approach. The first is technology. Using modern technology is a must. Real-time data sharing to support timely preventative investigative actions. Data analytics to support informed decision-making. Use of GPS cameras, biometrics. You can't pull a technological solution off the shelf, plug it in, and just think it's going to work that easily. Right now, state agencies are working to share data using antiquated systems, manual data entry, and fax machines. Agencies must have the ability to share accurate data real-time and use analytics to assess the massive amounts of data available. Criminals are using modern technology, and we're falling way behind them. Second one is oversight. A strong monitoring component is essential to achieve long-term success. History has proven that specific actionable steps to prevent fraud will not succeed without enforceable accountability across the board. Point persons should be identified and held responsible for effective implementation and execution. The types of sustained oversight and monitoring needed to achieve success should also include a level of public accountability. As a package, I believe these reforms will shift Minnesota from reactive enforcement, often years after the fact, to proactive prevention, creating a consistent, transparent, and enforceable system that protects taxpayer dollars while also supporting legitimate providers and beneficiaries. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you, Judge O'Malley. At this time, I'd like you just to stay either at the witness table or briefly in the audience, and we're going to invite our first witness up, and then if you would be available for questions after her testimony.
Certainly. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, I'd like to invite Faye Bernstein, DHS Compliance Manager. Good morning, Ms. Bernstein. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record to begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Robbins and members. My name is Faye Bernstein, B-E-R-N-S-T-E-I-N. I first want to just make a comment on the report and say the word that I think no one from DHS wants to hear again, but that's retaliation, the R word. I am a 20-year employee. I'm a current employee of DHS, and I am one of the very, very few DHS employees who can publicly speak about what the environment is there. We have a very large group. You probably have heard about the large group of employees who anonymously tweet and anonymously work with law enforcement and the OLA, et cetera. I have chosen to be public. I think it has certainly harmed me professionally, personally. It has harmed me in many ways to be public, but I feel like we have to just openly speak about the conditions at the Department of Human Services. The retaliation that I experienced was about 7 years ago. In the course of doing my job, came across some contract irregularities that I would consider in the scope of what we talk about today to be quite minor. But as minor as they were, it was not something that DHS leadership could hear. They just couldn't hear it. And as a result of me speaking about it, I was walked out of the building. I was banned from all DHS-owned and licensed property. So if you can imagine, the rest of the public can go to the Anderson Building and can apply for SNAP, and I could not. I could not use the ATM. I could not use the cafeteria. I was not allowed in the building. I was investigated. That went on for months and months. I can only imagine the cost to the state of that investigation. And I've never spoken out about the results of the investigation, but I guess this would be as good a time as any. The results of months and months of investigation and asking my coworkers for examples of when I was racist, when I was threatening to do harm to leadership, the result of all of that was that I was found to have questioned the competency and the decision-making of the leadership in the Behavioral Health Division, and I was found to have held up contracts that had compliance problems. So let me just say I plead guilty to both of those things. I absolutely did both of those things, and I'm doing both of those things today. I am very much questioning the competency of the leadership of the Department of Human Services. And I hate to do that because these are people I know very well. I think I know Commissioner Gandhi very well. I've had a lot of contact with her, a lot of time with her. But the actions, the mindset, you know, I heard you use the term fraud prevention mindset. That is not present. That is not present at the Department of Human Services. I don't know if I would dare to use the word compassion, because compassion sounds as if it is the right thing to do. Compassion when huge amounts of money are stolen is not the right thing to do. There has been just tremendous mistakes. And yes, I have been affected. I certainly did not appreciate being humiliated and being accused of a race crime. I certainly did not appreciate that. But more importantly, when we think about people this winter had fingers and toes frozen off because the Department of Human Services had to shut down a program. So people without homes had real consequences, much more serious consequences than I had. I do not see how we can come through this and actually quit this year after year, decade after decade problem. I do not see how we can come through this without a massive change at the Department of Human Services in our leadership. There just really simply has to be firings. And I hate to say that. I hate to see people fired. But there is no other way to turn this around. There really is no other way. It is so entrenched that the need to retaliate against people who speak up, as I initially did in the most benign ways, the need to retaliate against people like me is so ingrained. It is through every step of the process. Every person that I spoke to about this as I was working up the chain of command to try to get the contract problem resolved, every person I encountered, I look back now and I realize I didn't get a satisfactory response from anyone, even our internal auditors. I thought at the time I was being heard, and I now realize that I wasn't at all. We have an OLA report that I guess I could have written it. It's exactly what I was saying 7 years ago. So thank you for letting me speak to this. It's very important to me. I think it's important to all of you, and I hope you really hear what I'm saying about we need a dramatic change at the Department of Human Services. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Bernstein. So now we are going to spend, I would say, the next roughly 55 minutes, members. So we are watching the clock talking about this issue. We can ask questions of both of the witnesses. And then about 9:30, we'll switch to the periodic data matching conversation. So I have so many questions. First of all, Ms. Bernstein, thank you for your testimony. Thank you for your bravery in speaking out publicly. I know this has been a long journey for you and your family. And We are grateful. I know you speak on behalf of hundreds of others at the department who are so grateful for your willingness to speak publicly when they don't feel they can, and for people who have left and because they felt they were sort of hounded out, and you stayed to fight, and I think you're doing a great public service, so thank you very much. So to that end, I guess I'll let Representative Hudson go first. Will, if you can find your way to the testifier table, I think we're going to use a couple clips from you. So, Ms. Bernstein, if you wouldn't mind scooching over one, Will will sit at your chair to hook up to the monitors. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as I said last week, and I hate to sound like a broken record, but this is extraordinarily infuriating to hear, and I'm sure there's many, many members who have many questions, but there's a couple of points that I really think need to be driven home. My first question would be to you, Judge O'Malley. Based on what you saw in your investigation and putting together this report, were these fraud schemes primarily driven by sophisticated criminals who are just too smart for us, or were the weaknesses in our state oversight systems primarily responsible?
I apologize, Madam Chair and Representative. I'm very hard of hearing. If you could repeat that for me.
No problem. Sorry. So my question is, based upon your investigation, the report that you put together, were the fraud schemes that took place that have been documented and have resulted in prosecutions, were they primarily driven by the sophistication of the criminals who were involved? They're just smarter than we are, smarter than the state agencies, or were weaknesses, systemic weaknesses in our program integrity process, the primary cause?
Judge O'Malley.
Or Madam Chair, Representative, both, I think. The vulnerabilities have been there for a long time, and now there are very organized criminal groups that are taking advantage of those vulnerabilities. I don't know that they're way ahead of us, but they are. They're sophisticated. They're organized. They move about, change names, change addresses, do things like that, engage in multiple programs. They're able to do that in part because of some of the areas identified here that we just haven't stayed caught up, especially sharing data.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Judge O'Malley. I think it goes without saying that you don't have to be that sophisticated, Madam Chair, in order to hop a very low fence. And it's very clear from this report and from the testimony from Ms. Bernstein that the fence has been very low indeed. This reminds me of our most recent conversation in the Judiciary Committee, where we considered a bill to unredact the Optum report. And during conversation on that bill, it was noted one of the concerns, apparently from DHS, which we didn't really have a good opportunity to ask any of the people who were involved with the redaction because they didn't show up to that hearing either. But apparently one of their concerns is that were that report to be unredacted, it would present something of a roadmap for people who may not even be as sophisticated as the ones we've come across to engage in similar fraud. And if that's the case, what that means is that we know it. Because somebody read it. Somebody wrote it. So we know what the roadmap is, which means we know what the problems are. And when someone like Ms. Bernstein from inside tries to say, this is a problem, we need to fix it, she meets with retaliation. And the type, I want to be specific about the type of retaliation she describes. She gets accused of being racist. Well, that is consistent. One of the ways, you know, somebody might try to dismiss her account as anecdote. One of the ways to judge the veracity of testimony is to compare it against other evidence. And we have heard on tape, Attorney General Keith Ellison meeting with people who would later be indicted and some convicted in the Feeding Our Future scandal. And what was their entire premise of their complaint? The state agencies are being racist. And he bought into that. He said Walls feels the same way. That is consistent with what we're hearing from Ms. Bernstein right now. So the question becomes, why retaliate? What possible motivation could you have? What innocent and benign explanation is there for the type of retaliation that she's describing? I can't think of any. But the culture seems to be very intentional. I'll leave it at that, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hudson. So to that point, Judge O'Malley, one of my questions, and I have many, but I'll try to intersperse them with my colleagues. One of my questions is, in your report, you talk several places about how it's important to reward employees who want to speak up, like Ms. Bernstein. And could you comment further on that? My understanding from the whistleblowers who've reached out to us is that that rarely happens, and clearly that's been Ms. Bernstein and many other people's experience. So I just wondered, could you elucidate more what you mean by rewarding people to speak out? And then specifically, on page 47 or 46, I believe, of your report, you talk about how employees should give report allegations of misconduct. And I found it very curious that you say they should report to their supervisor, go up the chain of the command, or report to external authorities, e.g. the OLA, law enforcement, or the governor's office. But we expanded the whistleblower protection law last year specifically to include legislators, and you did not. And in my experience, people who went up the chain of the command got retaliated against. People who went to the attorney general's office got ghosted. I have multiple whistleblowers saying that. And yet in your report, you leave off the one group to whom whistleblowers have reported the most and felt the most comfortable with. So could you explain, A, what you mean about how we support people who speak up? You never actually referred to retaliation or whistleblowers that I found, but that's, I think, what you're addressing without calling it out. And then secondly, why did you not include legislators in that list?
I'll answer the second question first, Madam Chair, if that's all right. I use those as examples. I should have included the legislature, clearly. I didn't mean that to be an exclusive group. I just meant that if you are not receiving the proper responses, people are not acting on that, then go outside your agency. Go to law enforcement, go to the governor's office, go to the legislature, go to the OLA, go to anybody, but bring attention to the concern. So I apologize for not including the legislature. In terms of encouraging people to speak up, I have met with several both concerned citizens, whistleblowers, employees, former employees, who have raised the same concerns that Ms. Bernstein raised. They did bring those forward. Many of them did. They were not satisfied. Some of them were not satisfied with the responses. The few that I was able to dig into more deeply and go through the records of the investigation, I found that they followed the processes and that they were investigated. One side or the other side might not be satisfied with the outcome, but I was able to verify that they were addressed. Whether all of those were addressed as adequately as they could have been, I'm not sure. I suspect that more may come forward now with the attention brought to this, and I hope they do. And that was the point of this Appendix E, was that when that happens, we should make sure that not only HR, but law enforcement and others are prepared to thoroughly investigate that, gather accurate information, and make informed decisions, not gut reactions, not emotional decisions, not, well, whether there's smoke, there's fire. No, get to the real facts and then hold people accountable. And those that are doing the right thing, reward them.
Great, thank you. I'll come back to some other questions I have. Next, we have Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Judge O'Malley. Hearing Ms. Bernstein and then hearing you say that this is something that almost appears pervasive based upon your 1 month's worth of interviews that you did with folks within agencies, I'm curious if you, and this kind of follows the same lines as what Chair Robbins mentioned a moment ago, but What clear consequences do you recommend to these supervisors or people in some level of management that appear to not have taken action?
Judge O'Malley.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think it runs the full gamut, again, but based on accurate information. Get the facts straight. People make allegations, and sometimes they're well-founded, sometimes they're not. If a supervisor, a commissioner, especially a first-line or second-line supervisor who have the responsibility to carry this forward, if they don't deal with it properly, it could go anywhere from coaching because they don't understand to a form of discipline to termination. It depends on really a case-specific analysis of what took place.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm glad to hear you say that because one of the things that has been clear is that very few, if any, people have been fired within these agencies. At least it hasn't been public. And if we're listening to what other whistleblowers have said, it's that they've been retaliated against. They've faced essentially penalties for their actions, and the people up the chain have not. I mean, in the case of Commissioner Gandhi, who's been a compliance officer, a chief compliance officer, I believe, she's now the permanent commissioner of the Department of Human Services. That seems like failing upwards. And if what we're hearing from Ms. Bernstein is accurate and in line with the other whistleblowers that you have said to speak to, my question for you is the promotion of Commissioner Gandhi has happened while you have been around. So my curiosity is, if our whistleblowers are saying that we have a pervasive problem within leadership, why aren't we seeing firings today?
Okay. Judge O'Malley.
Madam Chair and Representative, as you mentioned, I've been at this for about 4 to 6 weeks, and I've met with a lot of people. I thought it was important to gather this accurate information and get it in front of the legislature while you're still in session. I don't know that I would conclude, as you have, that it's pervasive, the concerns. They're very important concerns. I have dealt with a few of the, or addressed and met with and followed up on a few of the allegations of retaliation, accusations of racism, those kinds of things. As far as Commissioner Gandhi and accountability for leadership, I didn't know her prior to when I started this a couple months ago. I will tell you that if there's good news here, and there is, every state employee I met with has a very strong commitment to helping solve this problem. They've been forthcoming, they've been cooperative, they've been very responsive to my requests. They provided any information I wanted, they adjusted their schedules, and they're working together on new approaches. I can't speak to Commissioner Gandhi's past as well as I can to having worked with her over the last couple of weeks, month, but she fits in that same category of being responsive and I think working hard to try and solve this problem.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, as you know, this huge level of fraud that we've seen across Medicaid-funded programs appears to, you know, all be within the lens and the time at which she has been at the agency and in a key compliance role. So when we're considering the fact that $9 billion has been the expectation that has been stolen from the taxpayers, and she was in those positions, and now she's the permanent commissioner, how are the people in Minnesota supposed to have faith in that? So I'm going to turn this around more so to what you mentioned in the first pillar, just talking about senior leadership, talking about how this can rise to creating a culture of stewardship of taxpayer dollars and program integrity. Do you think that the governor and his top officials have done enough to create that culture?
Judge O'Malley.
Madam Chair, Representative. Today, I think that is actually taking place, very much so. I think that everybody's watching. Everybody's paying attention. Here's the opportunity to make permanent changes that can make a difference. My job was to look back at those underlying factors, and they go back, as I said, a long ways. A lot of people played a role in this. Leaders in the executive and legislative branches, employees, providers, criminals, obviously. But to look at those and then project something for long-term solutions, and that's what the roadmap was designed to do. Is there more that can be done? Absolutely. I believe that the people in place now have the skill set to do that and are trying to do that. They're trying to achieve a balance between holding fraudsters accountable and supporting legitimate providers. And there's some tough decisions that have to be made, and they're making them in short time, short order. But I think now's the time to put together a more comprehensive package so that that balance is achieved.
Last one, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is interesting because I believe both in front of our committee as well as in the last couple of weeks, we have heard, I believe it's been the agency, say that they were too lenient, that they essentially spent, what was it, like 70% of their time or their principal being benevolent and generous rather than compliant with the law. How have you seen that change? And when considering that range, where do you believe the state should be in regards to compliance or benevolence?
Judge O'Malley.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm in 100% agreement with you there. It's in the report, the 70, 30, 60, 40 cuts. There was a mindset that has to change. I think there are a lot of state employees, especially at DHS and in other agencies, where they are motivated by this feeling of compassion for those that need help. And I would agree with Ms. Bernstein that compassion sounds soft and noble, right? And it is to some extent, but that's not the state's responsibility in my mind. The state's responsibility is to protect the money. If I want to help people in need, then I should do that directly. I should go out and deliver the wheelchairs, drive people to their medical appointments, do the bed baths, do those kinds of things. State employees don't do that. They need to have their highest priority making sure that the money that goes out from the state to those people who do provide the direct services, that money is used for its intended purposes and no other purpose. That's the way that they can help people who are most vulnerable and in need of these services.
Thank you. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got a couple of questions here about the report. First of all, I would note that in Appendix B, I'm sorry, am I coming through? Okay. In Appendix B, you talk about, how this problem stretches back decades across multiple legislatures and multiple administrations. So this isn't a new issue.
Is what?
This isn't a new issue, yeah. But, one that we're addressing very strongly right now. But and then elsewhere, I want to go back. I want to drag my colleagues here into the weeds on a couple of things that I think that are, you and I might be the only ones who appreciate them sufficiently, but let's bring them out. So on page 9, you talk about employing universal identifiers, implement ID numbers for providers, grantees, and recipients, and so on. Why is that so important?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm sorry, could you say that again? You're on page 9, is that what you said?
I'm on page 9, that would be 2E.
He's talking about employing universal identifiers.
Yeah, employ universal identifiers.
And the question is why, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, the question is why is that important?
Why is that so important?
Sure. Some of the entities that are committing the fraud with the greatest damage are gaming the system by changing addresses, emails, names, those kind of things. If we had a universal identifier for each person, each entity, each business, each nonprofit. Then when they change the names or whatever it might be, I think it would be much easier to track it. Right now, there are it's a paper system almost where you fill it out, you get it in, it goes to one agency. They'll look at that, and it might look fine on paper. So they provide the funding, they start enrolling applicants. That same entity might have a different name, a different address, a different email, and be in another program, and they're still getting the money there, or they've been denied from that program, but program A doesn't even know that program B has denied them.
Yeah.
Representative Elkins.
Yeah, to follow up. So, Judge O'Malley, are you familiar with the Login MN program?
Judge
Madam
O'Malley.
Chair, Representative, yes, I am.
Okay. And do you think that that would solve this particular problem if it was broadly employed in these DHS programs such that everyone had to acquire their unique identifier through Login MN and use it to enroll either as a provider or a recipient in these programs?
Judge O'Malley.
Madam Chair and Representative, yes, I do.
Okay. Right. Thank you.
Representative Elkins.
And then there's a lot of discussion here about the importance of data sharing. And of course, the legislature last year did sweep away any legislative barriers to the sharing of data across agencies in order to address this problem. So we've handled any legal barriers getting in the way of data sharing. But you would agree that having the technology in place to facilitate the actual physical data sharing has got to be an important part of the technology plan?
Judge O'Malley.
Madam Chair and Representative, absolutely. I believe a lot of the legal barriers have been removed. It's in part a matter of educating those who are sharing the information to make sure they understand their authority and the privacy concerns that go with that. And limiting that information to only those who have a direct business need to do it. Mm-hmm. But because that's in place, the answer, I think, is highly reliant on technology.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. I will get to you in just – well, go ahead, Representative Anderson, then I'll have my next question.
Thank you. And this goes along with that. So first of all, I want to thank you. I read your report 2 weeks ago. It's excellent. And I think if we implement this, we will solve the vast majority of the problems. So I really, really want to thank you for doing this. I'm not sure. I don't believe that we can solve the accountability and the culture problem with legislation. This is about we all know, I want to get to the heart of this. We all know there's going to be a new administration. We don't know who that's going to be, but we know that's going to happen next year. And whoever that governor is, they're going to probably spend the first 2 years cleaning this up and fixing this. And that's what they should do. And we're going to have new people. We're going to have new leadership. We'll probably have new commissioners. It always happens, no matter which party wins that race. But I want to do things that we can do now this session and actually get things set up. Representative Elkins has, I support the technology upgrades. I support additional oversight. Whatever we can do, I think it's the best use of our money this session to spend the money to upgrade the tech, especially for the counties. We need to get that done. I've been waiting to see, the governor talked about his fraud package, and he said a lot of the ideas were Republican ideas, and doesn't matter which party. But I haven't seen it yet, and I don't know if anyone knows where it's at, but we are 2 weeks from deadlines at this point, and that is really, really, really important. So does anyone know, do you, Judge O'Malley, know where that's at? Are you working on that, the legislative language?
Judge O'Malley.
Madam Chair and Representative, I do not know about that, and I'm not working on that language at this point.
Okay, thank you. Representative Pinto, do you know where that's at?
Madam Chair, if I...
Yes, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Anderson, I know the governor had announced that package, and I know that it takes time to get language through the revisor. I'm not sure of exactly that process, but I mean, I would assume that that is in process. We just know whenever there's agency proposals, it takes a while for the revisor to come out with language, if that's what you're talking about. I know the governor had announced some details of his proposal.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. And once again, I would like to note for the record that if the agency was here, we could ask them directly, but they are not present with us today to take questions. Representative Anderson.
Thank you. It's frustrating because that's what we should be doing. And rather than we all have these fraud bills, little things are picking away. I have a hearing and one tomorrow, I think. But we need to do the comprehensive package. And, you know, we could write it. I assumed it was being drafted by at least the beginning by the governor's office, but that has to get done. We're running out of time. So thank you.
Thank you. So I would like to go back to a couple things, Judge O'Malley, that I'm picking up on what Representative Schultz said about kind of the leadership. And we acknowledge that there have been changes and fresh energy to stop fraud, and we appreciate your role in that. But Will, if you wouldn't mind, I have not seen the culture change. And despite more than a year of hearings in this committee, multiple hearings in DC, multiple reports, including an OLA report in January of this year, showing how behavioral health division employees falsified and backdated documents. Like, we still don't have, in my estimation, leadership who is taking this seriously. And so I'm glad to hear you think differently, but I am imploring you to continue to push for that. And to that end, just to illustrate for you, because you may not have seen it, and for the public, I would like Will to play a few quotes, all from the last probably 13 months. So this is when this was well out in the open. People were talking about fraud. We had plenty of OLA reports for decades, as your report points out, and this is still the response of leadership. Quote, clip one, Will, please. This was January of 2025. Former Commissioner Jody Harpstead.
We do have to take that much into consideration because there's a lot of rumors of fraud more than there is actual fraud. And
so a year ago, the commissioner said there were more rumors of fraud than actual fraud. Okay, next. Will, if you wouldn't mind doing the MMB. So as you may know, Judge O'Malley, the Minnesota Management and Budget Department has statutory responsibility for internal controls over all state agencies. And one of the things that's most frustrating to me is that we had a hearing with them in January, and they claimed that they didn't really see, well, you'll see the clip in a minute. So, Will, why don't you run that clip, and then I'll do a follow-up question.
When that policy was violated in this instance, what are you doing about it? What happens when there's a policy violation?
Madam Chair, if there's a policy violation, there is, again, kind of similar to what MMB was discussing, there is not kind of an enforcement mechanism that the Department of Administration has.
So what kind of enforcement mechanism do you need? MMB, do you care to comment on this? Like, to me, this is the crux of the problem, right? We have one agency responsible for grants, one agency responsible for all the other finances of the state. And in both cases, you have a lot of policies, a lot of procedures, but when they're violated, no one does anything.
So forgive me, that clip was for the head of, for someone from Office of Grants Management. But previous to that, the commissioner of MMB had said the same thing. She said, well, we don't really see it as our role to enforce. We see it as our role to come along and support the agency so they can be successful. And she proceeded to say that the way that they check for internal control compliance in each agency is a self-attestation report from agency heads. So when you have looked at this, and we know MMB has statutory responsibility for internal controls, they do not seem to be doing their job. How would you suggest we hold them accountable for their responsibility or provide more specific direction to them. I offered. I'm like, you tell me the tools you need. I will introduce the bill. Let's go. And they didn't have an answer. How can we get at this when the leadership of these agencies is not taking it seriously?
Madam Chair, first of all, I couldn't hear the clip. I think I understand from your descriptions as to what happened. MMB has a responsibility to oversee the other agencies and how they comply with the different regulations and requirements. They do not see, and I don't think they have the resources nor maybe the direct authority to enforce it the way that they should. I agree with you. This annual attestation form is almost useless. Mm-hmm. What I would recommend, and I think it's in the report, I don't know which page, but I know it's in the report, that you arrange it so that MMB has an auditor assigned to every agency. If it's a large agency, maybe it's the single agency. If there are smaller agencies or smaller projects, smaller programs, maybe one auditor can handle several. That auditor would then have not just rely on the agency to say, yes, we've done these 12 things, but to say, here's the 12 things. Let me verify that. Let me come in and audit. Let me see the records. Let me talk to people. But have that auditor report to MMB, not through the commissioner, not through some agency. But have them be independent so there is no undue influence, so they don't feel influenced to try and please somebody. They're out there to do a clear audit based on the information they have in front of them, make recommendations, and hold people accountable in that way.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I think that's a good start. I do worry about the independence of that, even if it's MMB commissioner versus DHS commissioner, for example. The commissioners are all still appointed by the governor, and I do think there's concern about that. Mm-hmm. So in your report, you talk about the need for an appointed independent oversight monitor. This is on page 14 for anyone following along. And also you recommend, I believe it was on page 13, this executive branch compliance committee. First of all, I would like to understand your role, because you are the program integrity director appointed by the governor. My understanding is you're kind of that independent oversight monitor already that the report recommends. So are you, in fact, that independent oversight monitor? What is your current role?
Yeah, Madam Chair, no, I'm not. That's not my understanding. I was asked to come in, look at the history, look at the contributing factors, and come up with this roadmap recommendations going forward. One of the recommendations is that my role now should be transitioned to somebody who will have the independence, have the skill set, and have the backbone, quite frankly, to hold people accountable and move this forward. I understand that the way this was presented, there were some misunderstandings as to how long I'd be around and what I do. But I never agreed to stay for a year or longer. I agreed to use the experience I've had in other agencies that have tried to make the kind of cultural changes you mentioned a moment ago that are essential, that have to take place, and how it is that that can happen, but then have someone else come in and take over that role.
So you, this is breaking news in my mind, so you are not planning to stay a year and oversee this process through the end of the Walz administration? You view your role as settled now that this report is out?
Madam Chair, I don't know that it's completely over, but this was the brunt of the work I was asked to do. My plan is to still, and I've had the oversight, the coordinating council, some of the commissioners. I'm going tomorrow to one of the providers. I've told them I'll follow up with you. I'm meeting with Ms. Bernstein, I think, later this week, right? I'm going to do that, but it would be to help set the stage, as the representative just mentioned. What should we do now? You know, a culture change takes years, quite frankly. That doesn't mean it isn't important to take steps right now, but take those steps, and I think one important, along with technology, the other most important action step that should be taken soon is to make sure there is some point person. There is somebody who is responsible, an individual, not some entity, not some agency, but no, here's the individuals, one point person, but then others in each agency who will hold people accountable, will say, instead of checking those 12 boxes on your annual form, will say, okay, here's the recommendations that came out of the legislature. Here are the priorities from this roadmap. So in this agency, you need to do these six things, right? Okay, we're not going to wait a year. We need somebody to sit down with you in 2 months and say, okay, of those six, where are you? 1, 2, and 3 are done. 4, 5, and 6, we're way behind. Why are you behind schedule? What are the obstacles? Let's get them out of the way and let's keep this moving.
Thank you for that. It sounds surprisingly much like an independent Office of Inspector General that you're suggesting. Would you support the Senate bill that passed last year to create an independent Office of Inspector General?
Madam Chair, I would support putting someone in place to do what I just described, whether that's an Office of Inspector General or in another format, like I mentioned, the consent decrees. But you need somebody with that independence that is the point person that will come, and ideally in some public forum. Okay, a year ago, I don't think any of us could have imagined what was going to take place in the state of Minnesota in the last several months, in the last 6 months, the last year. History has taught us something else is going to happen, right? We probably don't even know what it is, but we cannot lose sight of the importance of combating fraud. And if it doesn't get kickstarted now, if actions aren't taken now to set the stage, then it will never get embedded in the practices, and that culture will not change.
I agree with that. My concern is your report. You suggest that independent oversight monitor is appointed. Who do you think should make that appointment?
Well, Madam Chair, I think the obvious answer would be the governor. However, I think that it should be with input from this body, and I think if it is someone with true independence, that'll become known. And if it isn't, if there's undue influence, the public scrutiny of that, I can speak from my experience. You asked me if I've looked at the governor's legislation. I have not. I may in the future here. I was going to be here last week, but I was unavailable. But I am going to stay engaged as part of this transition. But I will tell you that I've had complete independence. As you know, you saw the roadmap, as did the other legislators here and the governor and commissioners all at the same time. Nobody reviewed it. Nobody edited it. I was given freedom to make whatever recommendations I want. So I think there is an opportunity to have someone with that same level of independence. It was easier now for me than it would be long term. I would agree with that. But I think that the key there is that everybody still pays attention, and especially in some public forum. And if the person is not given that independence, it'll be on the front page and they'll probably walk.
I wish that were true. We've had all these hearings all this last year, and there's been incredible public pressure. The public is fed up, and it really hasn't brought the change that I think we have all been hoping for and seeking. And to that point about this need for an independent body for them to report to, you suggest this independent executive branch compliance committee. Again, it's embedded in the executive branch. And maybe in the short run, there will be independence somewhat. But I think unless we build independence into this institutionally, it won't stay independent. I think history has taught us that in a lot of areas. So I would ask for your support in trying to get a truly independent inspector general or monitor or whatever you want to call it. And my concern about this compliance committee is that it's within the executive branch. So they're all appointed by the executive branch, reporting to the executive branch. That's the value of having this independent oversight committee, which has now only existed a year. We are having public forums where you can testify, where other people from agencies can testify, and we do have some measure of accountability from the legislative branch on the executive branch. And I think if everything is just embedded in the executive branch, especially over time, it will not fulfill its function. And I would like your reaction to that.
Madam Chair, I understand your concern, and I would agree with you that history has showed us that if it's exclusively in one branch, that could lead to problems. The recommendation in the roadmap is that it, I don't care if it's in the executive branch or where it sits, but that there should be some public accounting. And the recommendation includes leadership from both the Republican and Democratic side, from the legislature, as part of that committee, and someone external as part of that committee. I'm not talking about 30 people. I'm saying you get somebody from the executive branch, people from the legislative branch, both parties, and an independent person that this oversight monitor would go to and explain to them, here's where we were a couple months ago. Here's what agency, here's what DHS did, here's what DCY, here's what Department of Ag did, here's where they're at. Kind of a report card. This is what was tasked to them. A, B, C, D. They've done A and B, C, D, and E haven't been done. Why not? Bring the commissioner and have him sit there right in front of you and a couple other, both parties and the governor and the external person, and explain it to them. The flip side is that when an agency comes and says, yes, we have done those things, recognize that, encourage that to continue.
Thank you. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Judge, thank you for putting this report together. I guess as I've been listening to the discussion, I've been thinking about how this is a complicated problem that we're trying to solve. The stakes are super high. In agreement with colleagues that have made the point, both this hearing and others as well, that it's outrageous when public dollars that are intended for vulnerable people are going to somebody else. And disentangling that, working through that is complicated. Well, first, I'm grateful that you described the complete independence that you've been given. I think that is terrific. And I hope, and Judge, you've been able to hear me, have you? I know, is that okay?
Better now that you moved the microphone.
Okay, good, thing. Judge. I'm going to try to get particularly close. I guess I maybe just want to caution our colleagues on the committee that, Judge, you've described having complete independence. I think it's clear from the comments you've made and the report that you've brought that independence to bear, and that there are things that maybe folks in the administration will like or not like, that individual legislators will like or not like. I think we need to be careful about, you've described to us what you've seen just in the last month in terms of culture within agencies. I think that you would say that doesn't undermine anything that happened before your interactions with the agencies. But I think we want to be a little bit careful. I was hearing some members of the committee challenging you in terms of the findings that you've made, that you have been the one that's been diving in deep in the last month. And I think we need to give some credit to that, which does not at all undermine the testimony of the person to your right. And we're grateful to you, Ms. Bernstein, for your statements, for joining us as well. I know that Judge O'Malley talked about the need to look into to have an independent investigation whenever there are state employees that are describing their experiences, and those experiences are negative as well. But Judge, I'm hoping that we can get into some of the details of your recommendations to make sure we can actually improve what we do going forward. So I have a very specific question for you on which is in your recommendations early on. I have to find it. On page 10 of the report, and I'm just really trying to understand some of the things you're recommending so we can make sure to try to take action on them. The final bullet on page 10, Judge O'Malley, talks about incentivizing qualified private sector investigators to assist in asset recovery. I'm familiar with the Federal False Claims Act and how well that works at the federal level, and think it's intriguing for us to consider that at the state level. As folks will see in the footnote, it's basically providing an incentive for private actors to, if they can identify fraud, to go after it, to assist state agencies in doing so. I haven't been familiar with doing that under law enforcement supervision. Can you just talk about that? Because I'll admit I'm trying to get my head around that, about how that would work. I'm really just trying to understand it.
Judge O'Malley.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think there are two approaches that you highlighted. One is to do it very similar to the federal legislation. Mm-hmm. I think that's a little bit more cumbersome, and it might deter some who would be very good at this from engaging in it. The idea of having some qualified investigators go after the money that went out, to have them coordinate with law enforcement. I know of a number of retired FBI agents, IRS CID agents, others who have tremendous experience in this, and especially in the federal system where you're really encouraged to retire at age 50 and you have another career ahead of you. I think they could jump into this game, if you will, and coordinate with law enforcement, not act as law enforcement, but make sure that they understand what their limits are. A lot of this work, I think, could be done from a computer. Mm-hmm. Figure out where the boat is, where the house is, where the bank accounts are, and then do that legwork and hand it over to law enforcement and coordinate the retrieval of that money.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so, Judge, can you think of other examples? I guess I'm struggling to do so where, because again, in the federal context, False Claims Act, the private citizens are just acting on their own through a civil action, and then they collect part of the money, the government collects the rest. I'm trying to think of other examples, and don't know if you can, of the model that you're describing, where it's kind of a hybrid where it's a private actor, but working under law enforcement direction. I'm not sure if that would mean they'd have some law enforcement tools or authority. I guess I start getting a little bit troubled in that mixing, but can you think of other examples of that?
Judge O'Malley.
Madam Chair and Representative, I think there are times when, in a lot of investigations, when private citizens provide valuable information that helps solve the crime or recover assets, a structure would need to be in place. Years and years ago, I worked narcotics for a long time, undercover work and all that kind of thing. There's a distinction between me going to a maid at a motel and saying, when you see something unusual, would you give me a call? That's permissible. That person is not acting under my direction. They're not doing law enforcement work. You compare that if I go and say to the person who's cleaning the room, do me a favor, when you clean room 15 tomorrow, would you do a real thorough job? Would you maybe lift the toilet cover and look underneath, make sure there's not something taped there? Or maybe it's time to lift the mattress and do a more thorough? No, then they're executing a search on behalf of law enforcement. So I think the distinction between giving them incentives to help law enforcement and having them do law enforcement's work, that can be divided. And it can honor the Fourth and Fifth Amendment. And it can be very effective, I think, in getting money back.
Lee Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A lot more thoughts and questions on that, but maybe that can be a further conversation. I know we're very tight on time. Maybe just the final comment that, again, really grateful to you for coming in this way and giving us quite a lot of information. I'm going to continue digesting it. I'm not sure if we may even have you back to digest this further, because there is a lot here. And a reminder that, what to all of us, that what you're directing to us, the concerns you're expressing are housed in the executive branch, also housed in legislative actions, and that similarly the solutions have to come from both places. Madam Chair, I heard you made the comment earlier about, and the video you showed, of kind of saying like, hey, we're looking to the executive branch to be giving us ideas or answering questions. I mean, if we need a policy to enforce violations of grants or enforce grant policy, and that was 13 months ago, I'd say, if somebody in this committee has that idea, we have a lot of staff. We don't necessarily even need to rely on the executive branch. So a reminder that we're sort of not helpless in this way. We now have information, and if folks want to turn these into proposals, they absolutely should do so. And in the meantime, I'm going to continue to rely on it quite a bit. So thank you, Judge O'Malley. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Lee Pinto. I do not feel at all helpless in this regard. I was just asking the department for their ideas for tools because they're the boots on the ground and what would be most useful to them. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I really appreciate this discussion and this report. And I think I share, especially as we, I think it's really focused on the accountability piece, which I think is sort of looking backwards, right? How did this happen? How are we holding people accountable, including folks who may have there not been thinking about the kind of oversight that we would want, thinking about leadership, thinking about the experience that Ms. Bernstein have. There's a lot of focus on the present, patching vulnerabilities, training and culture, and I think all of that is really important. One of the things that I think we also have been talking about and need to think about is the future. And I'm wondering, as I look at this, and as you've talked to folks, one of the things I think the conversation we need to engage is not just how to patch, but how to think about what has worked in other places, other states, other systems, and think about the systems overhaul, the program overhaul provision, not just taking at its fact how it currently is. I think we've identified all the ways the current system of fractured providers, right? We have, in many cases, thousands of providers, some public, some not. We have a different system looking at the oversight of payments than we do at the counties, and in many cases, private providers who are looking at the oversight of the programs. We have counties and cities and states and private providers, and I probably am missing folks. And so I think as we look future, right, not just in the next year, but the next 10 years, how we get to the bottom of it, I'm wondering if in this report, and totally acknowledging that it's been 6 weeks, if you've talked to other folks in other states or in other systems to look at what is working and what potentially different models we should be exploring as the legislature thinks about our job.
Judge O'Malley.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. I have looked at other states' plans. I haven't met with other states and got into the details. I found that those plans were at a higher level than what we needed here, and I tried to have the work that we did focus, you know, more specifically on the exact things that happened here, the things that are laid out in the OLA reports and that kind of thing, and tried to be responsive to those factors in coming up with specific ideas. There are other states that are doing well, but I think that for us to be successful here, I think the ideas laid out and that you've been discussing are the most effective. I might also mention that, and I don't know, Madam Chair, if I was responsive to you before when you talked about culture change and Representative, you talking about long-term solutions here. There does need to be a comprehensive approach, clearly. But culture change, as I mentioned, takes a while. Mm-hmm. But it's important to start right now. And it can be accomplished. And I'd offer two brief examples from my time working with the Catholic Church. You know, if you remember back to 2013, 14, and 15, John Choi in the Ramsey County Attorney's Office filed civil and criminal charges accusing the church of not protecting children, of permitting sexual abuse to take place, criminal charges included. So how do you go about changing that culture? These were far and away well-intended religious people who wanted to do the right thing, but there were some things that just weren't being enforced and weren't being followed up on, and thus the vulnerabilities. And the example I would offer is one time in our, you know, we filed a settlement agreement in Ramsey County that went on for 4 years, and it had a specific list of things that the Archdiocese was going to do. And I went every 6 months in open court in Ramsey County and testified where we're at on every one of those items. Channel 5, Star Tribune, CNN was there a few times. Public accountability leveraged that tremendously. Without that attention, it would have taken longer for culture to change. And the example I would give you is, at one point, one of the requirements was that every school needed to submit a report by a certain date. And there were 92 schools. We have 87 counties. You mentioned the counties. We need to involve them, right? Hold them accountable and make sure that they have the skill sets to do what they need to do. 91 of the 92 schools had submitted their report. And this was like 3 days before I was going to testify. And I called the principal and the pastor. And I said, here's the situation. You haven't complied. You need to get a report in. the woman who does that is on maternity leave. I'll get it in 2 weeks. In the old ways, it would have been, that's fine, I get it. Don't worry about it, just get it in. I said, that's your call. But understand, I'm going to go there, and I'm going to testify that 91 of 92 have complied. And they're going to ask which one. And I'm going to name you. You know what's going to happen that afternoon, right? Yeah. I said, everybody's going to be at your door, and they're going to want, the report was submitted. You know, that's the kind, it's not that hard. It's a matter of just doing it. It's a matter of actually doing it. The second one I'll offer just very quickly is there's three requirements. This is similar to the requirements of enrollees and applicants, providers. There's three requirements that everybody in the church has to comply with, whether you're a volunteer, a teacher, an employee, a priest, a deacon, a nun, I don't care. Everybody has to do these three things within a certain time frame. Our process put that in place to say you have to have it done by a certain date. About 3 or 4 weeks before that date, they get an email saying we don't have it yet, 2 weeks before. Finally, a couple days before, it would fall on me to give a phone call to whoever it was. And on the one instance, it was like June 28th, and it had to be done by July 1st. I called the person, and they were on vacation in California. I said, you've done two of the three. You've done the background, and you've signed the code of conduct, but you haven't done the training. You need to do that by July 1st. Otherwise, you're not allowed to engage in ministry. I'm out here through the 4th of July. When I get back, I promise I'll do it. I said, that's fine. Don't say Mass. Don't hear a confession. I'd suggest you not wear a collar because people might mistake you for somebody who is permitted to engage in ministry. It's not unlike having a license to practice law or a nurse. If you don't fulfill the requirements, you can't do your job. Well, no, I mean, I'll get it done. This is not my decision, Father. This is yours. This is your decision. If you want to engage in ministry, then you have to do these things. Little steps like that at the lowest level, at the supervisor level, this is what we're going to do. If you don't do it, there's consequences. That's how you start the process of changing a culture.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I agree that culture change is really important. I guess what I, as you move forward, and maybe this is a question more for the administration, but what it feels like is that the piece of this that really needs to get built out is the future of how we do things differently, not just the current people in power, not just thinking about how we add more training. I don't think we are going to just be able to change the people, the technology, and site visit our way out of this. I actually think we need to think about how we're changing the incentive structures about, for instance, having tens of thousands of providers, right? It's harder to oversee the Catholic Church than it should be to oversee for government to oversee its own entities, right? I mean, that's the problem we have with trying to regulate many private entities, whether they're privates or corporations or nonprofits. And so I think one of the things, as you are thinking about and having these conversations, I do think we need to think bigger and actually look for best practices of other places that are doing things differently than us, not just in the oversight, not just in the accountability, but I do think culture change also means not just accepting as given the system of provision of who provides it, how we provide it, how payments are made, who's overseeing them as a given, and put sort of Band-Aids on those vulnerabilities. But I think that we should be able to think bigger and say, how could we do this differently? How could we change the incentive structures from the beginning, not just of the regulators, but actually of the providers? And that is a part of culture change that's not just within the agencies or even within the legislature, but I think is the whole gamut. And so I think that there's work to do there. I would love, as you're continuing to do your work, to think about that. And if there's recommendations, even if it's not, if you're not the one who is going to talk about different models of service delivery, I think recommendations on who and how we would further explore that would be really useful to our work ahead, especially the legislature. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. Thank you, Judge O'Malley and Ms. Bernstein. I have a laundry list of questions. I will follow up by in writing. As Lee Pinto suggested, perhaps you could come back. We have many more topics to cover. I want to thank you both for your hard work on behalf of the taxpayers and the vulnerable citizens of our state. And we do appreciate what you've been doing, and we look forward to additional conversation. With that, we do need to move on to talk about periodic data matching, and I would like to invite former speaker Kurt Dout to the witness table to discuss this issue with us. Thank you. So members, I just want to outline why we're having this discussion. And it's because this is an ongoing issue that's been before the legislature. And again, I wish DHS was here to answer our questions on this. But I did have in your packet a bill that I submitted on Friday that is not actually before us, but I want to flag it for all of you because it will go to other committees as well. There has been a longstanding report in required by DHS on periodic data matching. And basically what happens is people who are on Minnesota Care and Medical Assistance or Medicaid are supposed to be annually checked for re-verifying their eligibility for these programs. The state established a program called periodic data matching, which kind of was an interim check every 6 months, and they were required to report that to the legislature every year on September 20th. September 1st. That requirement was suspended during COVID, but so they reported in January in 2019 and 2020. Those reports were in your packet, but then during COVID, it was suspended, but the law remains the same. And once the public health emergency ended, the department did not continue, as far as we know, either the responsibility to do periodic data matching and certainly no report. And we checked with the librarian at the legislature here. They also could not find the report. They had asked for it over the last 2 years, and DHS failed to respond to them. So this is a failure of the department to provide reports to the legislature that are required under statute. And so the bill that we will be considering in the future will just, that reporting requirement is set to expire on January 1st of 2027. And so at a minimum, I want to take away that reporting sunset so that we can get the department to get back engaged on this project and then get the reports up to speed. So with that, Speaker Dout is here because this was something he worked on when he was a member of this body and has very good insight for us on why this happened, how we got there, and why it is still necessary. Representative Dout, or former Speaker Dout.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And just on a personal note, thank you very much for the work that you're doing on this. This fraud thing, I think, has all Minnesotans of both parties frustrated, and frankly, they'd like to find real solutions to solve these problems. And as you know, I'm Kurt Dout, a former member of the legislature, now proud private citizen. But I still can't stop thinking about this place and the stuff that I worked on during the years that I was here. I served in the legislature for 13 years, and some of that time served as Speaker of the House, and appreciate my relationships with all of you. This particular program was something that we put into statute in 2015. For those of you that were here at the time, that budget was negotiated with Governor Dayton. There was a Republican House, a Democrat Senate, and those negotiations happened over at the governor's residence. They were hard fought. This was one of the things that I kind of laid down on the tracks and said, you know what, if you want funding for your agency, we're going to put some protections, some minimal protections in place. And they fought me tooth and nail on it, frankly. But we did get it passed. It did get signed into law in 2015. It was an HHS omnibus bill at the end of the 2015 session. The program was designed basically to do a couple of things. And it's a very narrow program. It covers people in Minnesota Care and on medical assistance. And it basically just checks to see if you know, and it checks different databases. Can be information they've given to Social Security, something they said on their tax return, but it basically checks to see if all of the information they've given to the state of Minnesota checks out that they are actually eligible for the programs. Not only did the administration fight me tooth and nail on not wanting to put this into statute, but then once we did get it into statute, it actually took 4 years to implement the program. And I will say this program is not a big deal. There are other states that do this, many of them don't need legislation to compel the administration to do this sort of check. This is just common sense stuff. Conservative bastion states like California, New York, Colorado, Washington all do this without legislation. They just do it. Mm-hmm. And what they're doing is they're checking to see if there are people on public programs that do not qualify. And I will make a blanket statement. If there, you know, the dollars that are in to be used for public programs are supposed to be a safety net for people that need those programs. When people are using those programs who are not eligible, it means that those dollars aren't available for people that need them. And it's our responsibility, or yours now, to make sure that we protect those dollars. And this program was just a very minor part of what we should be doing and can be doing to make sure that those dollars are used wisely. So the program actually, and we did in 2017 give them a little extension, but the program went into effect in 2019 eventually. Should have never taken 4 years. It should have taken 4 weeks to implement this program. It took 4 years to implement it. The program was actually implemented and started in September of 2018. And that first report that was due to the legislature came out on September 1st of 2019. Those reports are available online. I can forward them to you if you can't find them. There's two of them that were done, one in September of 2019, one in September of 2020. Both of them showed that this program was successful, and there were people in our public programs who were applying for these programs who were not eligible. The first year in 2019, just a quick summary, the report identified 580,000 individuals who were selected to just check to see if they were eligible. There were a little over 68,000 individuals who were identified as possibly ineligible. And then there were, at the end of the day, 22,990 individuals who were terminated from public programs as a result of those checks. Now, what the statutes or the law states is that we will kind of terminate your benefits, and then you have 30 days and you can supply the information verifying that you are eligible, and then your benefits can restart. Some of those people did do that, but at the end of the day, 20,386 people were permanently terminated that were ineligible for these programs. That is a successful program. I know that you are tasked with an insurmountable, or what seems like an insurmountable task, but you must do it. To find fraud and root out fraud in our public programs and with our public dollars. This one may seem minuscule. It is not. 3 to 6% of all people in Minnesota collecting these sorts of public benefits were doing so fraudulently. That's a big number. And in the second year of this program, and when I say second year, I'll explain that it wasn't a real second year, but 17,166 people were permanently removed from those two public programs. And the reason I say it wasn't a full year is because in March of 2020, this program was suspended during COVID by executive order of the governor. And the program was supposed to restart in 2023 after the emergency powers and the COVID-19 emergency ended. I want to talk to you about a little bit why I kind of started looking into this. When news media started reporting the amount of fraud that was going on in Minnesota, and I think we've all known that it's been going on and it has been a culture for years, and I think many of us have tried to do some things to try to curb that. This was one of those things. But when I saw the news reports kind of just continue, I thought, I did a couple of things when I was in the legislature to curb fraud, and I did those personally. I worked on them personally. I'm just going to go back and check and see. So I did some digging on this program, and what I found out was kind of shocking. This program was never reinstated after COVID. There were two reports that were done, one in 2020 and the previous one in 2019. The one in 2020 only covered a six-month period because the program was suspended in March of 2020. By law, current law, this program, and it is in current law today, it is supposed to be happening, and it has not happened since March of 2020. Okay? It is a successful program. During the term, the 18-month term that this program was in use, 37,552 ineligible people were thrown off of these public programs. They are people who did not qualify. They should not be receiving those dollars. I was shocked to find out that this program had never been reinstated. I started reaching out to folks and found a couple of people who had reached out to the department and gotten excuses as to why it wasn't or why it was delayed or whatever. But the reality is very simple. This program has been very successful. It did curb fraud in the state of Minnesota. And I will state very clearly that the Walz administration is currently defying state law to allow fraud to happen, and this is a prime example of it. And it isn't a partisan thing. This isn't a Democrat or Republican thing. Tim Walz isn't running for re-election. But it is our job and all of our jobs to make sure that we do what we can to stop fraud. You guys have been tasked with looking at things that don't exist in Minnesota statute. What can we put in? What protections can we put in place? What guardrails and barriers can we put up to make sure that we protect these dollars from seeping out into fraudulent programs? But this is one that is in statute. It is in current law, and it should be happening right now, and it's not. This administration is looking the other way. So I will note that I think it was in 2021, I guess I'd have to look through my notes here, but the report that's due to the legislature was sunsetted, and I think the chair said January 1st of 2027 or something like that. At the very least, I would remove that sunset. I can't imagine why nobody would want to know the results of a program like this that's in current law. And I think this is what can happen if you don't ensure that the legislature receives these reports, because nobody's going to check to make sure that the program is actually happening. And this one was a hugely successful program. It found a lot of Minnesotans who were on programs who did not qualify, and that is fraud. So with that, Madam Chair, you know, I just on another note, there's one statistic, and I think the previous testifier here talked about using your computer and just looking at data. We've seen stories out in the press about state public programs increasing over a number of years, and there was testimony in Washington, D.C. in recent weeks about these programs increasing 30,000% or some crazy number. You have to tell me somebody's looking at this. You have to tell me somebody says, gosh, all of a sudden this program went up two or three times. No, 30,000 times. You know, there are things that you can do and put in statute to protect those dollars from streaming out. And if it means an inconvenience, you know, put a stop that says if we spend more than twice the previous year's expenditure in this program, you have to get approval from the legislature to spend those dollars. Mm-hmm. Call it, if we're in the interim, call the legislature back in for a special session, and you can explain why this program has doubled in its expenditure in the last year. Bring them in and make them testify in front of you and explain why that's happening. But in this case, there was a 30,000% increase, and nobody caught that in the administration. That's shocking. There's one that I've been watching for years that falls in that same vein. And I hope there isn't anybody out there gaslighting, saying that there's no fraud in public programs in Minnesota. And I remember back in 2018, a story that somebody had gotten video, and I remember it very vividly, of $1 million in cash going through the Minneapolis airport and how shocked people were. And it led to weeks of stories about what was happening and where did this money come from and was this legal? And it is legal. If you fill out a form, if you carry more than $10,000 through the airport, you have to fill out a form. perfectly legal.
So we hope to have a hearing on that topic in the future. Speaker
Not Dowd. Trying to filibuster you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, so I do think people have some questions, so I appreciate you bringing this up.
But let me just, if I can, just two sentences on this. The fraud right now, or not fraud, but the dollars going out of the Minneapolis airport, $350 million last year and $350 million the year before. 99% greater than the largest airports in the country. We're the 16th largest. We have more money going out than basically all of the other airports combined. Mm-hmm. Think about that. Sorry, Madam Chair.
No, I agree. I testified to that when I was before the U.S. Senate, and we will be following up. The witnesses I have asked to come testify have been slow to engage with us, so I hope that they will indeed join us. But thank you for your discussion of this, and this is why it's very frustrating to me as chair that DHS isn't here to explain why these reports have not been restarted. And I would note for the record and for my colleagues that I spoke over the weekend to someone who I had hoped to bring in to testify, but by the time we connected, it was too late, so I am not bringing him here. But he is a national expert on welfare fraud. He's a welfare fraud investigator nationally. And he said that during this time when the COVID emergency was happening and the periodic data matching was not happening, other states under the Biden administration CMS rules were still allowed to take people off the rolls for death or for dual enrollment. And other states were doing it, and Minnesota did not. So for all these years, since the last report came out in 2020, we have not had these records reviewed, as far as we know, and certainly no reports to the legislature, even though other states continued to do it during COVID. So I, at a minimum, would love to get bipartisan support for this effort to end the sunset. And I would welcome any comments or questions. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Speaker Dowd, for being here. I am curious as to some of your experience in how you helped ensure that agencies were held accountable. And we heard a little bit from Judge O'Malley about enforcement on this. I'm curious as to your experience. What is the number one ways that you learned while you were a leader here at the legislature to ensure that agencies are doing what the law says?
Speaker Depp.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. That is the million-dollar question, right? Mm-hmm. What can you as the legislature do to hold agencies accountable, in this case to follow current law, in all of the other areas you're looking at to prevent Minnesota tax dollars from being used in a way that's fraudulent or not their intended use. The number one mechanism that you have, and you are, if there's one thing that I can tell you that I want you to know and believe, you are a co-equal branch of government. Use that. You have a lot of tools at your disposal, but the number one tool that you have is the dollars that you appropriate. Mm-hmm. The executive branch can't spend a dollar that you don't appropriate in state tax dollars. They can't spend $1 that you don't appropriate. You don't have to just pass a bill that says we appropriate, you know, $12 billion for this purpose. You can say, if you do this, and you do this, and you do this, and you operate this program with integrity, and you follow up, and you give us a report back, and you know, then we will appropriate these dollars. If you don't do these things, this appropriation is canceled, or you cannot spend money beyond this threshold or this limit. Mm-hmm. Use those tools, and I think you have to get creative to do it, but certainly, you know, this is an instance where there isn't something in statute that says if the department doesn't operate this periodic data matching program, you know, somebody's going to, you know, be charged criminally or civilly or, you know, that doesn't exist in the statute. There isn't a mechanism to say this is what's going to happen if you don't do this. But let me be clear. The Walz administration is defying current law to allow fraud, known fraud, to happen in this instance. That to me is somewhat shocking for an administration who is spending quite a bit of time and effort right now convincing people that the culture in their administration has changed, right? Proof is in the pudding. And this is just one example where that's not happening. But and you really need to
we put have 5 those, minutes, and I have 3 people who want to ask questions. So
you've got to put all those mechanisms in place to compel the administration to do that. But you have that ability. Do not just blankly appropriate money and write blank checks. Your job is to put those mechanisms into state statute to stop that. Go.
Thank you. Are you good?
No, I just have a
very quickly.
Yes, I'll be brief, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This legislation to repeal the sunset for this program will be introduced later today. I think that based upon what you said, we'll be seeking to add some teeth to it. In addition, I will just mention that the data provided in the 2 reports that they actually did identified between 20% and 40% fraud or misuse or abuse, 20% to 40%, and that's in each of these reports. You can see it right on the pages from 2019 and from 2020. And so on that, I will just say this recertification is essentially in line with what we must do as a legislature to be in line with what the One Big Beautiful Bill did. And so if we are going to stop fraud, stop the abuse, the misuse of the public dollars, we need something like this to ensure the integrity of the public's dollars. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've gone back and I looked at the 2019-2020 reports. Noticed that they only audited the portion of Medicaid program membership that is administered at the time through the Medicare Eligibility Technology System, METS for short. So it didn't cover any of the programs that were then and are now on MAXIS. Which includes all of the 14 high-risk programs where most of the fraud has occurred, and that would have been because currently MAXIS is just too old to be able to make the connections to the places to get the matching data. A question I have for former Speaker Dowd is, why did the legislature pull funding to complete the migration from MAXIS to METS during your tenure as Speaker?
Speaker Dowd.
Well, I think there were huge examples in state government where big tech systems, our MNLARS licensing system, there were huge failures at the time. Mm-hmm. And I assure you, by us stopping that, we probably saved the taxpayers $100 million or more, because those were the sort of numbers that were lost in these other huge tech programs. What the state needs to do is go out and find systems that are working in other states that are working well use those systems rather than try to write our own computer systems. And you know, going back to that time, you can just Google search and see all the examples where the state tried to create their own computer programs, and I'm failing to remember them all, but I remember MNLARS was a huge one. Representative Torkelson probably can attest to some of that. But we do need to upgrade our software programs, but we do not need state government doing it themselves when there are commercially available working systems that are out there that can do all of this stuff.
And, thank
and
you.
I appreciate that.
Lead Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had not been familiar with this report myself, and so I'm just diving into it. I'm looking at the 2020 report, one from September 1st, 2020. And looking at page 9 with the numbers, I guess I just wanted to make sure I understand. Of the 500,000 enrollees total in that top chart, there were 9% had some discrepancies, and then dropping down to the bottom chart, then 60% of those discrepancies were resolved and found to be eligible. 37% hadn't responded, and I noticed that there was just 30 days to respond. We're talking about folks with quite low incomes. That doesn't mean that they're eligible, of course. We just, you know, not sure what conclusion to reach. What we do know is that 3% were found to be not eligible, which is 0.5% of the total enrollees. I'm not on the Human Services Committee. We'll let the members of that committee review the proposal regarding the program. But I guess the idea the program found, you know, massive recipient fraud. We know that so much of what we've seen, the concerns we have, are with private providers. The idea that this found rampant recipient fraud, I think, is a bit of a stretch. What we found is that there's rampant low-income people who did not respond, which may be ineligible or not, ineligibility was found for just 1,300 enrollees out of the 500,000. So just kind of make sure of that point. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Lead Pinto. And I'll just point out for the record that of those 37% who did not respond, they were all disenrolled because statute says that if you don't respond, you are disenrolled, and they had the opportunity to re-enroll, and according to the data, the vast majority did not. So either then that they were truly no longer eligible, or they moved, or they died. So
or they were eligible and just didn't respond.
Or they never existed in the first place.
Yes.
Or, or they didn't respond.
Or they did not respond to their mail. Yes.
Right.
They all do.
But we need to verify eligibility. That's the law. And if they're not participating in that, then it's incumbent on them to do that. So, members, we are at 10 o'clock. We are adjourned. Thank you to all. Look forward to next week.